This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota, broadcasting live from the Rudy Luther Toyota studios at AM 950 Radio. It is the Matt McNeil Show for your Friday. Hiba Ansari is going to join us a little bit later on. Brett's got a conversation there where we're going to be talking about some things with the Sahan Journal. Also, it is a special treat for us, Patrick. Sven Sundgaard is going to join us on a Friday and give us a lowdown on the weather that we're going to be looking at coming up in the next week here, next week, I should say. So good news there.
I don't want to talk to him about those storms last night. I don't know if those woke you up, but you could just kind of hear the wind front come in like a train about 3 o'clock overnight.
It came in pretty strong. I didn't see any major branches down in our neighborhood. I mean, it's granted, though, it's a relatively flat area and there's a lot of trees, so it's not kind of like exposed. What happened to the Hudson, Wisconsin Library? Right across the river there, they got hammered. Sorry, guys. Also, the airport, not a lot stopping the wind out there, and apparently it tossed a few of the planes around. That tells you how strong it was. Planes got tossed around. That's kind of scary. But, it was a little bit nuts. And tragically, that young girl, 4-year-old girl down in Mankato, died in a tent, and a tree branch fell on top of her. We haven't had a lot of storms like this. And can I just say, how weird is it we're having these in September? These are like May, June storms, and we're having them in September. I mean, this is supposed to be a dry month. Trust me, I have been, as my kids have gone through their sports cycles, I have been at more than enough absolutely arid, dry fall soccer and baseball fields to get my fill. And so usually this is not the rainy season, but once again, everything is different now. Now that we've destroyed the environment, everything's a cornucopia of joy, isn't it? Oh, God. And we'll talk to him about that. Plus some other weather stuff coming on. He has a big breakdown on the drought. We'll get into that. Actually lifting a little bit here. Still really rough up north. We'll get into that a little bit later on. So, Patrick, in your life, you're a younger pup than me. I'm an old gray wolf. You're the young pup. Have you ever been in a bank where it looked like you were in a bank from like the movies, where there's a lot of people in there? Customers are being serviced at the counter, at the desks. It's a bumbling with activity. It's all sort of things. Have you ever been in a bank like that?
I have, but I haven't actually been in a bank since before COVID.
So, okay. I remember banking. I remember my dad taking me over, getting my first checking account when I was young. And you'd walk into a bank and you felt like you were at a financial institution. You know, one of those things. There felt like there was a formality there. Everyone wearing suits, everyone very, very, very serious numbers people. Don't mess with money. And it was busy. And there's a lot of activity going on. People talking about lots of different things and stuff. There is not many places more. Sorry to do this to you, banking industry. There are not many more places that are just as depressing as a bank lobby today. You go kick a soccer ball. And the problem is that a lot of these bank lobbies, they're set up still for banking in the 80s and early 90s, where they have tons of desks and offices and things. And there's two guys in this bank. I went to a bank today. I had to go pay a bill. I went to a bank. I said, there's a branch over here. I'll go swing in over here. And I zip on in. It's the bank is empty outside of two guys. Now, once again, there's like 8 teller positions. One guy's at the teller position. One guy's at a desk. There's offices and no one's sitting at any of these. Just as depressing and just kind of, lonely and creepy. Oh, man. Banks used to be kind of interesting. Now they're just, ugh. But, I mean, of course, everyone does everything online now.
This wasn't like Looney Tunes where you go to one desk and then you go over to the other desk and the same guy just quick like hops over and like, oh, I'm this person too.
I have zero doubt that they probably have like four computers set up and going, well, we need to actually go to the commodities computer. Let's go over to that desk. I have zero doubt about that. I mean, there are some things, there are a lot of things I miss. Sit down indoor pizza parlors. Holy God, were those great. When I was a kid, you go in there, red and white checkered tablecloths, video games. You know, I remember the first one I went into, it was all you could drink soda. Oh, mwah. And they bring the pizza on out to the table, and it's like it's an event. It's like an event. Today, it's, you know, just to go or deliver. It's, I miss those things. I don't know how much I'm going to miss banking, per se. But it is a depressing field, right? Sorry. Hey, someone want to blow the dust off Phil over there? Huh? Yeah, maybe tomorrow you'll have a customer, huh? Seriously. How much longer are they going to last even? How much longer are they even going to last? Especially when everything is done online. You know, you want to do investing? You want to do a loan? You want to do anything? It's all done online now. I have a feeling there's not going to be many banks left, that is going to be one of those things that when... Maybe not my kids, because there still has been banks, and I got them set up. My own dad did. I took my kids in and set up accounts for them. But for their kids, my grandkids, they're going to be like, Dad, what is this building where all these people and the safe? What's that all about? Yeah. All the crime movies where they break into the safe. Does anyone really have a safe anymore? It's ethereal. I've got, you know, some guy over here that's hacking the bank. That's what you got now. And that's not a good movie. Because usually there's lots of Doritos and Rockstar cans. And no, I don't want to. No, I don't want to. No, no. I've seen that guy. That's not movie material. Breaking into a safe, though. Ah, that's intriguing. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. A lot of things to get to in this hour because we are basically jam-packed full in the 5 o'clock hour. I want to start off, though, with the story that broke really as we got off the air last night. And that was, and give kudos to Jack Rice. Jack was on the air with us on Wednesday, and Jack was exactly right. And the guy knows his law, that's for sure. He just sort of said, I just don't see where in the world Judge Anderson's getting the toehold, basically, to challenge what the people who put this on the ballot are doing. I mean, the law is pretty clear. You get the signatures, you put the ballot initiative on the ballot, and you're done. That is not something that you can have a judge basically come on out and basically say, well, I just don't like how it's worded. And that's what she was doing. And I don't know. I actually really have some problems with Judge Anderson. And I know, Star Tribune, you think she's super nice. Isn't that great? Great fluff piece, Star Tribune. Anywho, but back in the real world, she really kind of overstepped her bounds. Let's go back through this. She initially tells them there's too much definition in the question. You have to shorten it up. So then they come back and they shorten it up. And then she comes back and she goes, that's too short. You need to give more definition. Okay, everyone shrugs their shoulders. Fine, okay. So they come back and they do an emergency city council meeting and they pass basically the just right, not too hot, not too cold, the just right version. And she still kicks it off the ballot. And here's where, for me, not only is, I mean, that's that all that there, those games that she was playing made me kind of like, okay, this seems political. But it was then when she said, and you have to send a note with everyone that gets a ballot to tell them not to vote on this. Now, that's when I was like, okay, this seems political. Not seems, this was political. I mean, it really, there's, I actually think that there should be a little bit of an investigation into Judge Anderson's decision here and where it came from and if she was consulting with anyone. Because reminder, her appointment through the Pawlenty administration hid the fact that her husband was a member of Pawlenty's administration. And she was grossly, I mean, she was not qualified for the judgeship when she was appointed to it. She was very young. I mean, it was by design. And here she is basically trying to, for lack of a better way to do it, undo the law. And the Minnesota Supreme Court, did not take long at all in the realm of things to say, no, you can't do that. And what's interesting is the Minnesota Supreme Court is a very literal group. They got a lot of grief early this year when they struck down those convictions and the charges in that one case because of the way they were trying to apply the law in the case of someone who had raped a girl that was drunk. And they said, we don't like this ruling at all, but the way the law is written, unless you guys fix it, we can't not rule this way. And that was a unanimous ruling. We had the ruling earlier this week in Muhammad Noor's trial, that basically the third degree murder, and Jack said it. And Jack reminded me, he indeed, back when Noor was getting prosecuted and charged, he said, I don't know if the third degree charge is going to stick. He said the problem there is that the third degree, the way the law is written in third degree, you've got to threaten more than one person. And from there's no matter how you say it, unless you're saying, and I believe he had said back then, they must be thinking that because he shot blindly into possibly people's backyards, that there's other people that could have been hit. But that's irrelevant. It has to be actually like shooting into a crowd. You can't just say, you know, hypothetically someone else could be there. And Jack called that one. And Jack called this one. And he just sort of said, you can't go on out there and just, when the law says, here's what you have to do to get a ballot initiative on the ballot. What's your ballot question? Okay, put it through. People can try to rewrite it, but that's not the case. The Supreme Court ruled in favor of the city of Minneapolis and yes for Minneapolis, allowing recently revised language for the police reform question printed on ballots to remain as is. The Supreme Court ruling struck down Hennepin County Judge Jamie Anderson's previous injunction. Anderson previously ruled it couldn't go to voters because the question, as written, didn't make it clear enough what changes a yes vote would bring to the city's charter. Once again, that's not your job. Your job is only to basically say, did they, you know, do what they needed to do? The city's legal staff asserted the wording in the ballot question complies completely with state law, which requires voters know that what's being amended and can distinguish it from other questions appearing on the same ballot. A representative for Yes for Minnesota told Care 11, we're very happy with the judge's decision. We're really excited to now be able to take it to the people of Minneapolis, the voters of Minneapolis, to decide if they're ready to expand public safety. Yes for Minneapolis Communications Director Jeanne Bates said, and this is really great day in history. Minneapolis City Attorney Jim Rowander also applauded the state Supreme Court's ruling, issuing the following statement. The city's attorney's office is pleased with the Supreme Court order tonight, which comes as early voting begins in municipal elections in Minneapolis today. He said tomorrow morning, but it's obviously today they started it. Now voters have the opportunity to make their voices heard in this ballot question. I would like to thank blah, blah, blah. Don and Sandra Samuels, who opposed the charter amendment proposal and were involved in the latest legal challenge of the ballot language, said they respect the Supreme Court's decision and have always supported the item going to a public vote. However, they urge voters to reject the ballot question. What's interesting is after the last ruling by Judge Anderson, they were out there saying, you people need to come and talk to us and work out the language correctly so we can agree on this. I mean, there was a very different tone. This whole, we always were a public vote on this. Really? Because it doesn't seem like it. And your press conference, or as someone said, someone wrote, as they posted part of the press conference, they said, what happens when the dog catches the car? They just don't know what to do. And they were kind of like, we won. And so they went out there and kind of said, hey, you guys need to sit down with us and work on the language. Well, I didn't think that was going to be an issue there. That's for sure. If we are really concerned about safety of our communities, we will vote no on that question, Sandra Samuels said. Let's be about the business of taking the passion for police transformation. We've got to have it and work with the police to bring it about. I got news for you. The police have no intention of bringing bat reform. Did you see the Stallings case? Apparently you did not see the Stallings case. My God. Mayor Fry, who also opposes the charter amendment, said it still is the right call for the state Supreme Court to leave it on the ballot. Is it? The charter amendment itself is fundamentally bad policy, Fry said in a statement, but that doesn't change the fact that the petitioners and the city officials have met their legal requirements. Minneapolis residents deserve the opportunity to weigh in on this fall, bring this debate to a close so we can move forward with clarity for our residents' safety. County election officials have already printed 350,000 ballots in the language. Early absentee voting in the city's election is set to begin Friday, September 17th. The current language, this is what the question reads. Shall the Minneapolis City Charter be amended to remove the police department and replace it with a Department of Public Safety that employs a comprehensive public health approach to the delivery of functions by the Department of Public Safety, with those specific functions to be determined by the mayor and city council by ordinance, which will not be subject to exclusive mayoral power over its establishment, maintenance, and command, and which could include licensed police officers, if necessary, to fulfill its responsibilities for public safety, with the general nature of the amendments being briefly indicated in the explanatory note below, which is made part of this ballot. So, needless to say, it's going forward. And once again, like I said, I'm glad I don't live in Minneapolis because I don't want to have any part of this, if you want to know the truth. I'm dead serious. The people that are behind this, once again, seem to really think that they're going to, that there's a way that you're going to be able to get through this without, or with a, at best, a minimal police presence, and that's just not going to be the case. You're going to have this new organization is going to have a substantial amount of police officers in it. And the fact that you guys don't seem to understand that leads me to question whether or not this was written in the best intentions. That being said, I can tell you once again, it's the police union. And the only way you are going to get real change is if the police union's current contract is dissolved and you can rebuild it from scratch. And right now, and the people that are against this ballot measure, what are you doing to address that? Are they saying, are they pinky swearing that they're going to do something? Are they promising they're going to do something? Because I don't see them doing anything. They don't have to, because their union contract basically prevents them from doing anything. The Stallings case, once again, just shows you how little interest that police department has in changing their ways. I mean, my God. So, good luck on that, Minneapolis. I have zero doubt you're about to see a ton of money poured into the city of Minneapolis on both sides of this. Where it ends up, I don't know. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. Minnesota coronavirus update. Some other things as well before we get into a very busy 5 o'clock hour. It is the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. Let's get into the Minnesota coronavirus update for today. The update from the Minnesota Department of Health includes 2,645 new cases, 13 newly reported deaths, 12 including September, and all occurring in September, one backlogged from February finally getting reported. A person aged their 30s in Benton County among the victims of today's report. Getting a lot more of that, unfortunately, sadly. The state's death toll is 7,983 since the start of the pandemic. I remember feeling optimistic that the death count wasn't really going to go up that much anymore 7-8 months ago. And then came the stupids. I'm never going to vaccinate. They're trying to control you. Why am I sick? It's just depressing. I mean, this is all caused by stupid people. That's just the insanity of it all. The dumbs. Ugh. As of September 15th, the state reported that 3,368,735 people have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. 3,187,694 people have completed the vaccine series. Though September 16th, the number of people with COVID-19 hospitalized in Minnesota was 719, level with the 719 report on Thursday. Of those hospitalized, 211 people are in intensive care and 508 were in general hospital care. My guess is, and one of the things I've just noticed the last few weekends,
the weekend numbers are where we see a pretty striking rise in hospitals, the hospital care. So I'm not sure exactly the, you know, if that's going to hold true, but that is one of the things that you definitely have seen. The 2,645 positive results in Friday's update were from 48,578 completed tests, creating a test positivity rate of 5.44%. Once again, the test positive rate for the last 7 days, 7.67, well above the 5%. Remember we were down at 1%? Dumbs. Just stupid people. Master, a violation of my rights. Stupid. I'm not a fan. An influential federal advisory panel has soundly rejected the plan to offer Pfizer booster shots against COVID-19 to most Americans. The vote on Friday, 16-2, was a blow to the Biden administration's effort to shore people's protection against the virus amid the highly contagious Delta variant. Over several hours of discussion, members of the Food and Drug Administration panel of outside experts voiced frustration that Pfizer had provided little data on safety of extra doses. And they complained that the data provided by Israeli researchers about their booster campaign might not be suitable for predicting the U.S. experience. One of the things I think is interesting about that is they have come back now. They have come back and they have just announced that they do recommend a booster shot for, let's see if I can track this down here, that they had actually come back and now are recommending a booster shot for 65 and older and people with other conditions. The FDA panel recommends Pfizer boosters for people 65 and older and those with conditions that make them at a higher risk. Scientific Advisory Committee recommended shots for recipients of the Pfizer BioNTech coronavirus vaccine who are 65 and older or at least 6 months after the second shot. Committee members advised that those considered at high risk should include healthcare workers, emergency responders, and others who are exposed to the virus by their jobs. They are recommending that people in the high risk of getting a severe COVID, such as healthcare workers, they should be getting it as well. So it's a beginning, it's a start. I will say it is a little curious. Pfizer is not giving you the long-term effects of extra bonus shots of what that does. But at the same time, they did come back and they say, yeah, okay, 65 and older, sure, let's get through it. Let's give them a booster shot. I also, and it shouldn't be a reminder, and we have to kind of put this out here. We do have flu season coming up, and we probably do want to make sure people are getting out there and getting their flu shots because that's just because we are still dealing with COVID. We had talked about this last year. It doesn't mean the flu season is not going to be dangerous. And you do not, trust me, you do not want to get the flu either. So make sure you get your flu shot. If you're available for the booster shot, I imagine they'll have details coming on out here before too much longer. I want to tell you what, I'm going to take a break. When I come on back, Star Tribune's got an interesting story about the way that the Twin Cities hospital beds are being used in Minneapolis area here. And I did, once again, a question about how they report these numbers. And I'll get to that here in a second. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Just FYI, if you're watching the live stream, Radio for Your Eyes, that of course over on Facebook at AM 950 Radio or at Progressive Citizen X Matt McNeil Show on Facebook, they are back up and running. We had a little computer issue there. Just FYI, those are back and going. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Now, I have brought up the point that the Star Tribune seems to go out of their way to highlight whenever vaccinated people get COVID. And what sometimes is, when you look at the overall numbers, is the vaccinated people, The breakthrough cases, they call them, are a minor problem compared to the unvaccinated, which is a far larger problem, which if you're trying to talk about the public interest, obviously you should focus on, oh yeah, the 99.9% of people that are getting it are getting, you know, are unvaccinated. I think it's actually like 97.6 has been the latest number. 97.6% of people hospitalized or dying of coronavirus right now are people who are unvaccinated. That would be the alarm you'd think you'd set out. And I've been kind of surprised the Star Tribune has always seemed to kind of go on out there and try to take it from the mentality of let's talk about those vaccinated people first. And it's interesting because I had a doctor, and I went through a health crisis earlier this year. And I had a doctor, and it was interesting. He would talk to me a little bit about certain things. Like what's the prognosis here? It's like, well, there's a chance something really bad could happen. And it's like, yeah, and you know, you got to be prepared for that because something bad could really happen. I'm like, oh, okay, I didn't realize this. Oh yeah, that happens 25% of the time. Oh, so I only have a 25% chance of getting that. 75% of the time, I'm not going to have that problem. So the vast majority of the time, 3 out of every 4 people are not going to have this problem. Oh, yeah, sure. He did it again. He goes, oh, well, you could have this issue. You could have this issue. It's very serious. Like, oh, wow, really? Okay, I better be prepared for that. Yeah, about 20%. Okay, 1 out of every 5 people. So 4 out of every 5 people don't have this problem. Yeah, they're good. And you're like, oh, okay. There are some people that just like to focus, or just the way that they present things that does kind of focus on the negative. And that's fine. You know, as long as you give the full details. But at the same time, when you're dealing with a public health crisis, why would you bury the lead? There's no reason to do it. And the Star Tribune consistently does this with their COVID response. Listen to how this story unfolds. Vaccinated people with COVID-19 might be taking up more hospital beds in the latest COVID-19 wave, but new data from the Atlanta. So vaccinated people with COVID-19 might be taking up more hospital beds. How does that sound to you? Doesn't it sound like they're saying, well, the vaccinated people are taking up far more beds than the unvaccinated? Doesn't it sound like that? I understand what they're trying to say is more than they had before. But still, why do you lead with that? I mean, it's still the vast majority of people taking up hospital beds today are unvaccinated people. Ta-da! Isn't that better for the public? I mean, I don't know what you're trying to do here, wordsmith, but you're definitely, I mean, that first sentence on your story makes it seem like, well, the vaccinated people, they're the ones having the problem. And I understand what you're trying to say, but come on, you got to read through that. Is someone proofreading your stuff? New data from the Allina Health and Health Partners Hospital System show that they aren't as likely to require intensive care or ventilators. Okay, so finally they come back with that. But still, once again, the first paragraph's entire focus is vaccinated people. And let's get to the second paragraph. The two large Minnesota health systems on Thursday joined with a few others across the country, including Sioux Falls-based Sanford Health, reporting their COVID-19 hospitalizations by vaccinated stats and severity. The chart provided by Minneapolis-based Allina showed only that 38% of 150 patients hospitalized with COVID on Sunday were vaccinated, a rate of 25%. And then only of 8 of 32 COVID-19 patients in intensive care were vaccinated, also 25%. So, once again, your entire, the story here is clearly, once again, and even though these numbers are better, and by the way, if you're wondering, why are the numbers up to 25%? Well, because I think there was another story I read that 3 of the metro counties are at 80% vaccination rates. 3 of them are at 80%. I mean, so there's just not as many people to infect as far as unvaccinated in the metro area where Allina and Health Partners have a lot of their facilities. So I'm going to guess that has a large part of it is the fact that the people that are getting the Delta variant, because most people are vaccinated, is going to start seeing a larger percentage. But still, overwhelmingly, for every one person that's vaccinated, there's 3 people who are unvaccinated. The story here is still 75% of the people that are being seen that are in intensive care or in just in the hospital, 75% of them are unvaccinated. And once again, you go back to that first sentence and you're like, okay, is your whole point here just trying to make it seem like vaccinated people are the bad guy? Are you so dependent on outstate rural Republican red districts buying the Star Tribune that you're kind of putting the news in a position to where it basically is, hey, guys, don't feel bad. Let's talk about those vaccinated people first. No, if you're the media, aren't you doing a public service by informing them of the news? Which would be, wow, 75% of the people that are hospitalized or in intensive care are unvaccinated. Ta-da! That is your first, well, you can remove the wow, but you can there is your first sentence of your story. I don't understand what is going on at the Star Tribune that they are desperately trying to, they're desperately trying to basically, you know, in any way possible, let's talk about the vaccinated people first and foremost. I just don't get it. Health officials hesitated over the publication of this data, worried that people would interpret any such COVID-19 hospitalizations as a sign the vaccine isn't working. Well, it's not as long as you report the facts that 75% of the people in the hospital and are unvaccinated. 75% of the people in intensive care are unvaccinated. And by the way, I mean, who is concerned? I think maybe your concern is maybe the media basically presenting this in a way that tries to say, look, there's vaccinated people. Yeah, but they're still dying at a much lower rate than the unvaccinated people are. And if you're concerned about social media and what they're going to do to twist this around, well, then, you know, I'm sorry. That's basically, you know, the howler monkeys. If you're basically saying we didn't want to release this data because we know the howler monkeys are going to start screaming, well, let them scream. The data is the data. Part of the problem that we're having in this country is that we just do not have people that have the guts to go on out there and say, well, and this is one of the things I do like about Biden, because we don't have enough people like Biden going out there and saying, hey, stupid, get vaccinated. Do you want to die? No? Okay, get vaccinated. And media that basically is trying, it seems like they're focusing things on is like, let's make the stupid people feel better about their choices. Let's make sure they're not feeling too bad about you know, the fact that they could die. Let's make them feel better. Let's talk about those vaccinated people first. I just, you know, this isn't rocket science. The vast majority of people who are sick, the vast majority of people who are having trouble, they are the unvaccinated. And those are the people that should absolutely be getting torn to shreds on this issue. They absolutely should be. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Moving away from coronavirus, I want to get to Enbridge here. Because the Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, I'll get to a point in the story where they just made me laugh. They just made me laugh. The Minnesota Department of Natural Resources, the DNR, has ordered Enbridge to pay $3.3 million for piercing the groundwater aquifer during construction of its Line 3 oil pipeline in northwestern Minnesota, the DNR announced on Thursday. The rupture released more than 24 million gallons of groundwater near Clearbrook since January in what the DNR says is a violation of state environmental law. The agency's civil enforcement order includes requirements for Enbridge to pay an additional monitoring and restorations of a rare type of wetland near the breach. Enbridge's actions are a clear violation of state law and also of public trust. This never should have happened, and we are holding the company fully accountable, said DNR Commissioner Sarah Stroman in a news release. Oh, please. You're not holding them hardly anything. First of all, you can give them a $3.3 million penalty. This is Enbridge. This is a massive billion-dollar corporation. That's pocket change for them. So as you sit there and act as if you basically gave them a stern spanking, all you gave them was a stern finger wagging, and they're really not listening to you anyway. And also, can I bring up the point? Didn't these clowns basically have tons of other breaches? You guys were focusing on this one and acting like, we got them. Okay, well, what about the other, 20 or so? Isn't that they've had spills and they broke through the aquifers and the Mississippi River? And aren't you guys supposed to be monitoring this for the people of Minnesota? Or are you just basically in their checkbook at this point? dear Lord. I mean, this is one case, and I guess great, but you want some real teeth. How about for every violation Enbridge has done, they get a $3.3 million fine?
Well, if we do that, what's going to happen is they're going to take us to court, and they're probably going to win because, you know, we just don't have the heart to fight it.
Really? You got tons of heart to fight the Native Americans who don't want this pipeline out there. You got tons of heart when it comes to violating the treaties once again. Have no problem doing that, right? Have no problem doing that. And you have no problem ignoring the fact that once again, this is this clown car parade. This is them drilling the pipeline. There isn't oil going through the pipeline. They're just trying to drill. And the people that have sat there and supposedly for years had time to set up their game plan and their geology and how they were going to do this seem to be doing this on the fly with the dumbest people involved digging the pipeline. And it's spilling like crazy already. And this is before the oil. And at yet no point on line three are you guys out there acting as if, well, maybe we should look out for the public interest. No, we already see what you're going to do. Eventually, when the courts do get around to ruling in favor of the Native Americans, you guys on the DNR will be like, oh, you know what we should do? Let's put up a memorial talking about how they were right and we should have never allowed this to happen. As you know, maybe right next to the pipeline as it still is going. You know, maybe that's let's put it on a memorial for all the people that were fighting this in the first place. Because, you know, their voices should be heard after the pipeline's built and after it's spilling all over the place. You guys could go on out there and basically stop this pipeline at any point. But you're not going to. And all of a sudden, at the end of all this, when the pipeline's leaking oil all over the place, you guys are going to be like, hey, you know, it's almost like they knew this was going to leak all over the place and they lied to us. Boy, oh boy. Well, lesson learned. Now, we're going to have to charge the taxpayers of Minnesota tens of billions of dollars to clean up the mess because, you know, we're not going to go make them clean up their own mess. No, never not going to do that. Jeez, I mean, come on, you guys act like you've done something here. How about the rest of the violations? You know, the ones that they're preventing, you know, the water protectors from actually seeing, but we know have happened? Enbridge's actions were a clear violation of law and public trust that never should have happened. We're holding the county fully, the company fully accountable. Oh, shut up, DNR commissioner. Just shut up. Holding them fully accountable. This is going on your permanent record. Enbridge spokesperson Julie Kellner said the company is still reviewing DNR enforcement documents. Enbridge has been working with the state since June to provide information and develop a corrective action plan, which is being implemented, she said. We share a strong desire to protect Minnesota waters and the environment that we've committed to restoration. Enbridge saying this. We will continue to work closely with the agency on the resolution of this matter. Sure you will. Enbridge's construction plans call for digging a trench up to 10 feet deep, according to the DNR. It said the company dug a trench 18 feet deep with a large metal sheet used for trench support installed as deep as 28 feet. The result of the aquifer breach, the Enbridge didn't notify the DNR agency, says. Once again, they lied. The agreement was 10 feet. Their plans clearly showed they weren't going to go by that. Independent environmental monitors noticed unusual amounts of water in the trench in late January, worked on managing the water over the next several months, but the monitors enforced permit requirements, not construction plans, so they didn't identify what Enbridge's failure to follow construction plans led to the aquifer breach. The DNR realized there was potential aquifer breach in mid-June. Just your crack staff there, huh? Started an investigation, ordered Enbridge to stop construction on the site until there was a plan in place to stop the flow, which was technically a complex issue requiring good data. The released groundwater has been pumped from the trench, filtered to remove sediment released to a nearby wetland. The DNR referred the incident to the Clearwater County Attorney for criminal prosecution, alleging the company violated state law that prohibits appropriating waters of the state without previously obtaining permit from the commissioner. The civil enforcement order requires Enbridge to pay $300,000 for groundwater loss, $250,000 for state monitoring of rare wetlands near the breach, $20,000 in administrative penalties. It also orders Enbridge to create a $2.75 million fund for restoration and mitigation in nearby wetlands, which will the DNR will oversee. The Minnesota Pollution Control Agency is also investigating potential Line 3 permit violations. More than 10 spills of drilling fluid, a mix of mud and chemicals. And they're not, that's under counting it. I mean, I'm pretty sure it's up by 20. Ogama would be able to tell us how many breaks they've had. Enbridge's 337-mile Line 3 is almost complete. Once again, I think this is one of the saddest part about this is the DNR does not give a rat's ass about the people of Minnesota. Because if they did, they'd be stopping this pipeline at this point. I mean, they've proven, Enbridge has been proven, they can't be trusted. The Pollution Control Agency, if they cared about the people of the state, would have stopped this pipeline. Because it's clear Enbridge doesn't really give a rat's ass about the people and the safety of this line. They just want it done. Just tragic. Tragic. Oh, but I can't wait for a union guy to, well, they're going to give us a ton of jobs. Oh, yeah, the jobs that never really materialized. Or are you talking about the jobs where they shipped in workers, where those people were abusing women in the Bemidji area? I can't remember which jobs you're talking about, but they never, I don't think the jobs ever materialized. If all you did, you built three foundries. Listen to me, Northern Minnesota. You built three foundries, steel foundries. Three foundries that processed American taconite. You'd put the taconite mines back to work at full speed. You'd have everyone back to work, and you'd be making U.S. steel for U.S. projects. And you wouldn't have to necessarily pollute the living crap out of northern Minnesota with toxic sludge from Canada. But
hey.
Yeah, I'm tired of you clowns. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here. Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Get ready for the wambulance. Representative Jim Hagedorn, bag of soup himself, said the expulsion of his wife, Jennifer Carnahan, Grand Canyon herself, as chair of the Minnesota GOP is the result of a small but vocal clique that bullied her out of the position. Jim, funny story. If you're talking about bullying, have I got some reports to read to you? Holy God. Anyway. In a Facebook post on Thursday morning, the first district congressman defended his wife's record, praised her response to the allegations. Oh, you remember when you first kind of came out and said he deserves his day in court? I remember that. Yes, I remember that. And blamed cancel culture for what unfolded in August, the two wed in 2018. Cancel culture. Oh, Jim. Your victims. You pathetic mules. Dear Lord. Oh, you're the victims. No Minnesota GOP chair ever worked harder with as much energy as Jennifer, wrote Hagedorn. Well, considering the, you know, the stories of the treatment of the staff, I'm not going to necessarily disagree with that. Hey, Carnahan, first elected the state party chair in 2017, was pushed out by a divided executive board on mid-August. Now, it should be noted, the executive board was full of Carnahan loyalists. From everything I have seen, the vast majority of the Republican Party wanted her gone. Really, most of the people that support, I know a lot of people that supported her until the Lazaro thing came up, and they were like, no. When the details started coming out about that, they're like, no. So the small minority are the people that have defended Carnahan, which includes, unfortunately, enough of the board members where she was allowed to vote to give herself her own commission check. Wow. Or severance pay, not commission check, severance pay. Let's see here. She cast her the final vote that awarded her 3 months' worth of severance pay. Her ouster came following a turbulent week. First, Anton Lazaro, a Republican operative who was her close buddy and ally and a guest of her wedding to Hagedorn, was indicted for child sex trafficking. Then came reports that she failed to respond to numerous sexual harassment and assault complaints made by activists and Minnesota GOP staffers under her watch. Remember that bullying part there, Jim? Yeah. Carnahan has denied their claims about the behavior, blaming them on disgruntled individuals. They're all! It's not me! It's all them! It's not me! It's all them! I'm innocent! Poor Boo Boo Kitty! Hagedorn, in Thursday's Facebook post, took direct aim at these allegations made against his wife, writing, "It's sad so-called Republicans using the tactics of the radical left to cancel culture our duly elected chair and create needless chaos for our party." Oh, really? It's the people holding Jennifer Carnahan that are the villains of the chaos, you say? He blamed his small clique of perpetual antagonists, some acting out of pure hatred. Guilty as charged, who dusted off substantial allegations made during the 2021 re-election in order to conspire to trumpet false narratives through the media, the sole intent to remove Jen as chair. She has suggested she's going to run for office, including maybe as governor. That is my theory. She is just dangling out there, hoping someone writes her a check to stay on the sidelines. I honestly think so, because it would be delicious to see Jennifer Carnahan run for governor. Please do it. Seriously. Hour two up next. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Matt Patrick here on your Friday. Sven Sundgaard going to be coming up here. Hiba Ansari is going to join us from Sahan Journal. Is going to talk with Brett here in just a second. But Patrick, I want to start off here with a breaking story. The second man wanted in connection with the killing of four Minnesotans whose body were left in an SUV in Wisconsin cornfield has been arrested. The Dunn County Sheriff's Office announced Friday afternoon that Anthony Darnique Suggs, 38, turned himself into police in Gilbert, Arizona. Suggs has been living in Phoenix, Arizona area recently before traveling back to Minnesota in the last couple of weeks. At this time, it's unknown how Suggs traveled back to Arizona. The 56-year-old man was arrested in St. Paul. In connection with killing early Thursday morning. He's been charged with four counts of hiding a corpse as part of a crime following the deaths of Natasha Lee Flug Presley of Stillwater, Matthew Pettis, Lois Foreman III, and Jasmine Christine Strum, all of St. Paul on Sunday. Witnesses told police they saw Suggs late Saturday night in a bar on West 7th in St. Paul with Flug Presley, and then saw Flug Presley, Strum, and Pettis get into the black SUV just after 2 a.m. with an unidentified black male driving. I don't know the charges, though. Hiding the corpse, it makes me wonder, where do they believe that people were dead before they were driven to Dunn County in Wisconsin? I'm not quite sure. Their bodies were found 70 miles away near the Sheridan Town Hall in northern Dunn County. One of the victims was in the front passenger seat. The other three were in the rear seat. The driver's seat was empty. So, yeah, maybe that's what they're expecting, is that they're saying they think that as well, that's the one guy drove him out there. At this point, no motive has been released. Suggs has not been charged. He'll be taken to Maricopa County Jail in Phoenix before being extradited to Wisconsin. Once again, the FBI helping out with that case, and I'm guessing that's why this thing has kind of moved so quickly, but he did turn himself in. Yeah, so it's at least to me, it sounds like they were dead before they got to Dunn County in Wisconsin. And so, and if you've got witnesses that play Suggs with these people, the real story is going to come on out here fairly quickly. Julie is in Minneapolis. Let's get her call in here really quick because we got a big full hour coming up here. Hey, Julie.
Sure, yeah, quick call. You know, I got to get this off my chest. I've been feeling a little bit angry and a lot insulted the last few months because I'm a Minneapolis voter, longtime Minneapolis resident, homeowner, and I feel like I've just been insulted time and time again in the opinion page. You know, Minneapolis residents aren't smart enough to figure out this ballot question, and it just irritates me. and I don't like being treated like a child, and I think I am smart enough to figure it out. And so I feel that the Supreme Court did make the right decision. I agree with you that they just decide things on the law, period.
Yeah.
And I know a lot of people are unhappy, and I like Don Samuels. I met him years ago. I think he's an intelligent, great person in a lot of ways. But it doesn't sound like he's too thrilled about having all of Minneapolis vote on this issue. And I know where he's coming from, and I do respect that. But I like to get a little basic respect that I'm not too dumb to figure out a ballot question.
Well, and it does seem like, and thanks, Julie, I appreciate the phone call. It does seem like that is a narrative you're going to get a lot of. Those stupid people in Minneapolis just don't get it. Well, no, I think they do. And I also just sort of say, do you understand what the hell's been going on in this city now for the last few decades? I mean, it's been going on pretty much forever, but the last few decades, there has been an undeniable trend of targeting and attacking and killing the African-American population. And we talked yesterday, we had the Reuters interview on, police just aren't doing their dang job, and I understand they're having staffing shortages, but the staffing shortages are about 25%. Some of the police job responsibilities, their numbers have dropped 60, 70, 80%. They're just not doing their dang job. And you keep acting, and people keep acting like this is normal, that the police are, you know, them having a pity party and not doing their job is, well, we should concern ourselves with their feelings. I mean, I don't know. I think the people of Minneapolis figure this out on their own. And needless to say, I think that it's a mess. And there is, I can understand both sides of this argument. None of this is good, but it just tells you how bad things have gotten with the Minneapolis police, that this is where we're at. Cities that don't have the Minneapolis police do not have referendums like this. They just don't. The cities, there are tons of cities in this country where there still is problems, but they don't have massive referendums to basically completely shut down the current police department and start a brand new one. Tells you how bad things are with that Minneapolis police department. And if you want to just ignore that and just act like things are going to fix themselves, I think you're a fool. That's where I think you're a fool. If you think that this police department has given us any implication that they don't have to change, they will change, please. They're not going to change. So I don't know how you fix this, but my gut feeling is if you are the city of Minneapolis, this is your window to negotiate. Because I think that you could go back to them and it's like, well, either your department completely disappears or else, you know, we're going to have some transparency. We're going to have, you know, we're going to have, you know, a lot more transparency. We're going to have a lot more accountability of officers that are doing bad things. And we're going to have mental health checks of all officers. And I think if you got those three things pushed through, you might not see this ballot initiative pass. Because I think people will say, well, they've agreed to enough. But now's the time to negotiate, because now the police are really going to be under pressure to basically not have this pass. So 952-946-6205. Todd Colad, sponsoring AM950. Todd, thank you very much. We do appreciate that. Todd lives in Spain, can't visit our sponsors, and so he sponsors the radio station itself, and we do appreciate that. 952-946-8885. 952-946-8885 is the phone number there. You can call in and find out how you can get sponsored. Of course, Todd's got a band, Just Folk. They've got a new single out called Is It Monday? And we've got a link. I just put the link back up on social media today. Go take a look at it. And thank you very much to Todd. 952-946-6205. Sven Sundgaard coming up a little bit later on. But right now, we've got Brett Johnson, does these great weekly interviews with us. His interview today is with Hiba Ansari. With the Sahan Journal, they're going to be talking about rent control proposals and the election on both sides, Minneapolis, St. Paul. A lot of good information coming up here. Here's Brett Johnson with an interview right here on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Brett Johnson with you here on a Friday afternoon. Well, one of the big ballot measures that has been in the news recently has obviously been the police charter amendment in Minneapolis. But there actually are a couple of other charter amendments in both Minneapolis and St. Paul. They're very important to be paying attention to, as they both have to do with controlling rent in both Minneapolis and St. Paul. Since, well, unless you've been living under a rock, you probably know rent has been increasing quite a bit for over the past few years, and I'd even argue over the past decade plus. So Hiba Ansari is with the Sahan Journal, and she wrote a nice comprehensive piece explaining what's on the ballot in Minneapolis and St. Paul, with these rent control measures, as she joins us now. Hiba, thanks so much for joining me.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Absolutely. So, as I was talking about, we have these rent control measures in both Minneapolis and St. Paul. And before we start diving into detail about both of the proposals, since there are some major differences in the cities, what exactly is the situation like now, right now, for renting in Minneapolis and St. Paul? Is it worse for lower income people and for immigrants? Just kind of lay this landscape of what rent looks like right now in both towns in terms of how much it's been increasing recently.
Yeah, I like how you said it before. Unless you've been living under a rock, you probably would know that rent is increasing. The issue in Minneapolis and in St. Paul is that rent is increasing more for low-income renters, especially immigrant renters and people of color. So rent control is supposed to kind of target or at least alleviate people who are experiencing the highest rent increases, which would be low-income renters in the Twin Cities.
Gotcha. And what's been driving these increases over the past few years, as you had a chance to speak to a number of people who have been either for or against? Do they give any indications as to why we're seeing those increases?
Yeah. So it's hard to say, but I think for people who are sort of, you know, on the real estate development side, kind of attribute increasing rent to things like improvements and construction. All of those things cost money. And so that comes out of a person's rent. And if you're living in a building that needs repairs, it needs to come up to city code, that cost is going to come out of your rent. People who are, I think, advocates for rent control sort of say that increasing rent has been a form or a tool of displacement for low-income renters, especially renters of color. And you kind of see it if you live in some certain neighborhoods. Gentrification is a big issue, and so supporters of rent control kind of say that development itself is driving up the cost, but that development is not necessarily serving the communities that live there and, are a community there. So it's hard to kind of say, but all of those things have a lot to do with rising costs. The issue, though, is, and this is kind of why it's impacting low-income renters in particular, is that even though rental rates are increasing, income itself is not increasing at the same rate. So it's making it even harder for people to keep up with those increases. Otherwise, it wouldn't be an issue if rent costs went up, if your income is going up too and you're able to afford it.
Yeah, and
unfortunately, that's not the case for a lot of people.
Yeah, and you hit the nail on the head right there with the income increases not keeping up with those rent increases. And I think anyone just needs to drive around Minneapolis and St. Paul just to see all the luxury apartments and luxury condos being built. So that, yeah, certainly is a contributing factor as well, as you were kind of talking about. So let's dive into both of these measures right now being proposed in Minneapolis and St. Paul, since there are some key differences in terms of what's being proposed in each city. Let's start off with the city of Minneapolis, because as I understand it, what residents are going to be voting on is essentially just giving the city council, as I understand it, permission to enact some rent control measures later on with the new city council. Can you explain a little bit more about what's happening in Minneapolis with their rent control measures and what's on the ballot?
Yeah, so if you're following the Minneapolis city elections, you've probably heard a lot about charter amendments and charter amendment ballot measures, especially when it comes to the policing ballot measure, the public safety ballot measure, that was, all over this week. But rent control is another one of those questions that Minneapolis residents are going to see on their ballot. But they're not necessarily voting on a rent control policy itself. So the city of Minneapolis has something called a charter, which kind of acts as a constitution. And the purpose of a charter amendment is to, you know, amend the city's governance rules, constitution, so that they can eventually come, and by they, I mean the city council, can eventually come up with a rent control policy and then bring it back to Minneapolis voters to then vote on. And the purpose of this is to sort of get around a state law that kind of keeps cities from enacting rent control. So if you're living in Minneapolis, you're not necessarily voting for rent control. You're just voting on the city council's ability to write a rent control policy that then you will get the chance to vote on down the line. And that policy could look, you know, very different. There are lots of cities in the country that do have rent control, but you know, there's no one size fits all solution for a policy in Minneapolis.
And as you write in your piece again over at the Sahan Journal, which you can find over at sahanjournal.com, sahanjournal.com, is that, yeah, there's going to be lots of decisions that are going to be made if that ends up passing in Minneapolis. But as we move across the river over to St. Paul, they have a much more concrete question that they're asking their residents, and or a much more specific question in terms of what they're asking residents about rent control. Tell us a little bit about what's being proposed in St. Paul right now.
Yeah, so St. Paul is already at the point where residents can vote on a rent control policy. The ballot itself specifically called it rent stabilization, which essentially means the same thing. But that policy, if passed, would limit landlords from increasing rent more than 3% annually, and that's on all units in the city, including new construction. So the ordinance would also keep landlords from increasing rent to market rate after a tenant moves out. Supporters of rent control kind of attribute that last piece to a way that bad landlords have been able to drive out tenants who are on the low income side. In St. Paul, if that policy passes, some landlords can request an exemption to surpass that 3% cap if property taxes increase or if there are significant construction or renovation costs that come up to ensure the building meets the city's housing codes and standards. So if that is passed, the city of St. Paul would see rent control starting by May 2022.
And as I understand it, and you were just mentioning this, that in St. Paul, they do cap rent increases if this passes at 3% with no exemption for new construction, which, as I understand, according to opponents of the rent control measure in St. Paul, that's a significant point of contention, being that they're not exempting new construction on that 3% cap.
Yeah, people who are sort of advocating against rent control are really concerned about not exempting new construction because, you know, part of the reason why rent is going up is because there just isn't enough housing on the market for people. And so to kind of solve that, you ideally would want to build more apartments or build more houses or build more places for people to live. So not exempting new construction, which is costly, from that 3% cap, opponents of the policies, have real concerns about how that might affect development and how that could manipulate the housing market in St. Paul. And if, you know, a similar policy ends up passing in Minneapolis, it could really affect according to opponents of the policy, it could really affect the housing market in areas outside of Minneapolis and St. Paul as well.
And I imagine the city of Minneapolis is probably happy that St. Paul is going first in that regard, so they can see how that does end up impacting things over in that city. So it is interesting that, yeah, St. Paul is a little bit further ahead in terms of passing rent control measures. But let's dive into that million-dollar question, though, that I'm sure a lot of people are wondering about. Does rent control actually work? And I know you answer this in the article with, I think, with a good answer. Depends on who you ask. So I'll let you detail a little bit more about what you were able to find out when you talked to a number of people who are both for and against proposing rent control and whether that policy works.
Yeah, it really is an it depends type of question, because like I said before, there are other cities and also the state of Oregon across the country that have forms of rent control in place, but it's really hard to use them as a comparison point. Proponents of rent control see it as a solution to, you know, increasing housing costs. And it really is a way to protect tenants against rent increases, especially people on that lower income side. And that can allow them to then stay in their homes and develop a bond with their neighborhood, participate in a community. It keeps their kids in schools in that area. They're able to work then in a manageable distance from their home because they have a home. And again, like I said before, proponents of the policy kind of say that increasing rent has been used as a tool for displacement historically. And they really urge people to look at the history of racism in the housing market in not just Minneapolis and St. Paul, but in the U.S. And so rent control would really prevent displacement for particularly Black, Latino, and Asian residents in neighborhoods where they're, you know, a larger population. On the other hand, people who are against rent control would say that it doesn't work and that it actually discourages, like I said before, developers from building more, more apartments, more housing. That would make the shortage even worse. I'm trying to figure out how to word this. It would also rent control, because it caps the rent at 3%, mm-hmm. It would keep property owners from maybe investing into their buildings for more repairs and improvements. So the quality of the housing would also go down. And, you know, some landlords might even just take their properties off of the rental market and just turn them into condos. So it really is about how we not only keep housing affordable, but also keep housing accessible and make sure that there's enough out there for everyone. And I think people on both sides of the spectrum agree that rent stabilization isn't going to be the only thing that gets us there. There are going to be a lot of other solutions that the two cities will have to weigh. And, you know, rent stabilization itself isn't going to be the fix-all solution.
And I want to talk a little bit more about differences between small and big landlords, because it's easy sometimes just to think as a landlord as being one person or one corporation, but obviously there are differences between when you have someone who is just owning one property and it's just a single person that owns it versus having some of these big corporations that own multiple properties all over Minneapolis and St. Paul and the rest of the metro area. Talk a little bit about the aspect of how rent control could impact landlords, both big and small, because as I was reading through your piece, it sounds like it could be a little bit different in terms of how it impacts big landlords versus small landlords.
Right. So the biggest difference is that smaller landlords who are, you know, looking to invest in their community have in the past not really increased rent at exorbitant rates. And they're kind of, you know, maybe increasing rents $30, $40 here and there, not even every year. So for those landlords, they won't really see an impact to their operations or to their income. And their residents won't see much of an impact to their rent either. But when it comes to larger corporate, when it comes to larger corporate landlords, rent stabilization is really meant to target the ones who are, you know, developing and increasing rent to keep lower income residents from renting out their units so that they can make a profit off of renters who make a higher income. And you know, that's not good for a neighborhood. That's not good for community. And so it really, you know, rent control itself is meant to kind of target those sort of landlords, and rather not your small, like, mom and pop landlord who, you know, is otherwise really operating in an ethical way and isn't really, you know, driving their tenants out by, you know, increasing their rent hundreds of dollars every year. That's the main difference. The main difference there.
We've been speaking with Hiba Ansari. She is a reporter with the Sahan Journal. Again, you can find more of her work and the rest of the great writers over at the Sahan Journal over at sahanjournal.com, sahanjournal.com, as Hiba recently wrote a piece detailing these ballot measures being proposed in Minneapolis and St. Paul that could have a significant impact on rent stabilization in both cities. So if you happen to live in Minneapolis or in St. Paul, make sure you vote on that ballot, since we have some very important questions that are being asked, and Hiba did a good job kind of detailing those different proposals in both cities. Really appreciate the time today. Again, find your piece, Hiba, over at sahanjournal.com. Thanks so much for joining me on the show today. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
All right, we'll take a break and send things back to Matt McNeil on AM 950.
AM 950, the progressive of the Matt McNeil Show on your Friday. Sven Sundgaard from Bring Me the News and Premier Living has generally joined us on Thursdays, but this week he joins us on a Friday to talk a little bit about the storms we had and the storms that are going to be coming on up. Hey, Sven, how are you doing, my friend?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm doing well. I did lose a little sleep last night. Those storms
did
came
you?
In. Oh, yeah, they came through with some power. I mean, and once again, once you look out and you see what nature is unfolding right in your own neighborhood, it becomes kind of the best must-see TV you can have, because it really is truly amazing what nature can do.
Yeah, I slept right through it. But, you know, it did wake up a lot of people. I live downtown, though, so I'm used to noise, and I sleep with a fan on, so I'm not going to hear anything unless it's, you know, it'd have to be real substantial. But yeah, it did wake up a lot of people.
It sounds like National Weather Service is now saying two tornadoes did hit Burnsville Apple Valley. At one point with this, I think it was the second line of storms here, there was some concern that there were quite a few cell areas that could develop into that, correct?
Yeah, so we had those two rounds. You know, the first round was earlier in the evening, you know, between about 6 and 9 p.m., and there was a tornado warning on part of that line of storms for a while. I don't think it ever produced anything, but it was, you know, in a pretty remote area there of north central Minnesota, where if it did touch down briefly, you know, we're relying on either spotters who would be able to see it, or you know, obviously somebody would have to see that damage, and it's just very difficult to do. Actually, I'm just pulling up. They did say, oh no, not tornado, but funnel cloud. Yeah. So we saw lots of pictures of that. I was just trying to refresh some of the reports. But yeah, that second round of storms developed in South Dakota and started producing strong winds right just west of Sioux Falls. And then it continued through southwestern Minnesota right into the metro. And, you know, unfortunately, people may have heard that a four-year-old did die last night.
Yeah.
They were camping. A tree branch fell on a tent. You know, kind of a nightmare scenario. You know, this is an area where we all like to camp in the summer months. And, you know, this is always a possibility. And, of course, that is one thing. But even in your home, this is sort of the worst-case dangerous scenario, is to have this kind of weather. It was between 3 and 4 in the morning. You know, most of us are fast asleep. In my old life, I would have been awake at that time, but not most people are. And yeah, what probably happened were these gust NATOs that developed, because you do have a line of strong winds. Even the airport measured a 64 mile an hour wind gust at 3:18 in the morning. Yeah, St. Paul, the airport there, Holman Field, picked up a 60 mile an hour gust. So those are severe gusts. That's enough to knock down big branches or even trees. And remember, we're in the opposite problem is that we had much of the summer. Parts of the metro have pretty wet soil, and so it's easier to topple over trees. And so, yeah, what happens is on the edges of these wind gusts, you can get these tornadoes to develop. They're not usually as strong as what you'd see in a supercell, a more organized storm, but they can definitely do some damage. You know, if the wind itself is 60, 70 miles an hour, there's no reason that these gustnadoes can't be of similar strength. And that's why the Weather Service goes out the next day to determine what happened. Most of us saw straight line wind damage throughout the South Metro. It's basically pretty much all the reports line up just south of the Mississippi River or close to it as you get towards Invergrove Heights and Mendota Heights. But I know in Cottage Grove, where my brother lives, there's a lot of power outages there. And in Hudson, their public library lost part of its roof.
Yeah.
So there was some substantial damage. It was noisy for most of us, but it really seems like it was the South Metro. As you're talking about Burnsville, Eagan, Lakeville, over towards Cottage Grove, basically, and Hudson, Wisconsin, that saw the brunt of this.
Are we seeing more abnormal wind storms, wind events that are happening? Because, I mean, let's face it, I guess we expect these kind of storms in May, maybe June, September. I've been in enough sports fields in fall now with my kids that usually this is a dry month. I can't remember much of this happening. We had that storm that hit Iowa was last year. We had the storms that hit Minnesota, Wisconsin earlier this year. Are we seeing more extraordinary wind events starting to pick up?
Well, you know, actually, this year actually is, you know, many things that are odd about this year, and some of them are weather. We had the severe weather of this season is actually our lowest we've had in two decades. This is the least active, and it kind of makes sense. We had the worst drought since 1988, so it makes sense that it would be some of the least activity since 2000. But we are seeing severe weather season extend a little more because we're seeing warmer periods. You know, I think we talked about this spring, the new 30-year normals. Some of the biggest changes were in September and December, some of our fastest warming months. And so that would stand to reason then that we're seeing an extension of the August severe weather season into September. And actually, it is late summer, August, that we tend to see these kinds of wind events that do happen sometimes late at night. I know because working a morning show where I was up at 2-3 in the morning routinely, that these things tend to happen late at night. If they develop out in South Dakota, and they do often hold together, by the time they reach the metro, it's in those wee hours of the morning. And you always worry about, you know, how many people are paying attention. That's why, you know, the Weather Service says this too. The best thing you can do is radio or download one of these apps on your phone that will alert you in the case of some of this impending weather. But, you know, it's hard too when you're in a dead sleep and all of a sudden something goes off and you have to react, you can imagine. But particularly, I would say campers, anybody who's camping in our region should have some way of staying abreast of the situation. And obviously that's hard in a place like the Boundary Waters if you're in an isolated spot. But it's about the best we can do.
But it brings up an interesting question, because when I was a kid, you'd always go camping. You had a weather radio with you, and it seemed like that was something that the Forest Service or something like that would always be broadcasting on some AM frequency, and they'd have it out there. Are they still doing that, or has everything really gone down to cell phones now?
I think they still do it. And, you know, they do have receivers that I think cover much of the Boundary Waters and Superior National Forest for that, you know, emergency reason. But there are still pockets of that area that, you know, you avoid pretty much all communication. So, you know, you are traveling at your own risk. And I don't know about you, but I've been deep in the Boundary Waters during some pretty nasty storms at, you know, 2 a.m. And you're thinking, gosh, should I, you know, jump to the lake? Am I safer out there, or am I safer on land with these gigantic trees that, you know, hopefully there's just so many of them that the other trees catch one if it falls?
That's a big hope.
What a nightmare. Yeah, you know, exactly. But like, I don't want to jump into the middle of Seagull Lake during a wind event either. That, you know, would be like the Atlantic Ocean.
Yeah. The one thing I will say, and by the way, if you're not, you should be following Sven's YouTube channel, but you also should be following his Twitter feed and social media. You are still getting, and I love this, you do get a lot of people sending in your cloud weather pictures to you. You've had quite a few. The cloud formations we saw with this storm were pretty extraordinary too.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah, there are a ton. And that's how, you know, if I paid attention to nothing else, that's how I know something's going on, is just based on what I'm being sent by people. And a lot of people saw these Mimatis clouds, which are not unusual. There's always somebody who says, I've never seen these before. And I'm like, well, you probably weren't paying attention then, because they are somewhat common. Anytime we get a strong storm, you usually get these ahead of or behind the storm, because it's basically, imagine the air rises into the storm and then it's got to come out, you know, in sort of all directions around the storm. And as that cool, dry air tries to descend, the upper level winds sort of smooth it out. And you're literally seeing pockets of air trying to descend, cool air. They look ominous. Untrained eye, people are like, oh my God, are these just a series of funnel clouds? They're not. But it is usually the sign that there is a strong storm nearby, or it was at one time. But yeah, a lot of people saw those. You know, I posted my videos today and retweeted, I think, at some point last night. Joe Nelson, Bring Me the News, loves to amateur storm chase, and he saw the funnel cloud from that storm just north of Little Falls yesterday evening. There's some pretty cool photos. A few people got of those as well. But yeah, it's got everybody's attention. It made for some pretty sights. The one thing that was unique about the Mammatus clouds we saw yesterday, though, that I haven't seen before, is they were kind of in striations, rows, rather than just more of a random clump of Mammatus clouds. And that was sort of the ripples of wind. We had a lot of shear in the atmosphere, which is why some of those storms were able to rotate last night.
Pretty remarkable. And you brought up the wind damage that was done at the airport. I think one of the few of the planes got tossed around out there, and that the poor library over in Hudson, it sounds like Richfield also got some, and then of course South Metro. It does put it in perspective when we don't have buildings here that are designed for, you know, tropical storm hurricane winds on a consistent basis. I mean, they're pretty well built, but they're not built for that. And that yet we saw the damage that happens when a hurricane hits. We should mention we do have our latest tropical storm did finally develop out on the East Coast. Odette is now there. It doesn't look like it's going to affect too much of the American or Canadian coast, but poor Greenland. This is going to be like their third hurricane or tropical storm they're going to get up in Greenland.
Well, yeah, and I don't know if people saw that the remnants of remind me the name now. It's hard to keep track of them. We're like 20 in. That dumped all the rain on New York. I'm having a blank right now. Mm. Anyway, it was the last one. Dumped a ton of snow. It'd be a blizzard for Greenland. And so much so that they said, for the first time in a long time, and it's very temporary, Greenland actually has a net balance in its ice content on the ice sheet. That's how much snow fell, you know, where it's rapidly been losing it, of course, especially in the summer months. But so much snow fell. I mean, you can imagine you have a tropical system moving into a polar region like that. It's just going to dump a ton of snow, and it's just incredible.
Wow.
But yeah, the Atlantic is getting active, and we just reached the halfway point this week. We've had 17 named storms that have made landfall in the last 17 months. The average is 3. So it's been 2 active seasons in a row, and the Hurricane Center is watching 2 systems way out that we do have to be paying attention to, some cyclones that are developing between Africa and the Caribbean right now. They give a 70% chance of one of these developing into a named cyclone in the next 48 hours, and so I have a feeling we're going to be hearing about those. So we're only halfway through the season. And it's been an active one for the first half. No reason to think, with all the heat that's out there, that the second half won't be too.
And the last thing, I just want to, the poor folks in Louisiana, and you know, not only did they get hammered by that one storm that made landfall there, but then this latest one, and it's all of a sudden you get...
It just
poured on them. I mean, if another storm hits, and the way that they're developing in the Gulf of Mexico, I'm not going to be surprised if another one hits them. You know, it's almost like, okay, maybe you guys should move. We should just get you guys out of here, because I can't see how many people could go through this. And this just seems to be getting worse and worse and worse.
Yeah, and as we talked about, they went into hurricane season a foot and a half above normal for rainfall for some of those areas. So it is just saturated. And that's an area already that is just set up for disaster because it's so close to sea level and relatively flat. Yeah, it's halfway through the season. There's no reason to think that there won't be a few more, and it's just going to be a mess. And that whole area, Houston too, we all saw what Hurricane Harvey did 4 years ago. So, Gulf of Mexico, one of those areas that I put in my top 10 list of places that with climate change is going to be really particularly vulnerable, and a place where people will probably be moving out of over time, because you can only take that so long. I had an aunt and uncle who lived in New Orleans for 25 years, loved the city, loved the culture. Hurricane season was a normal way of life, you know, and they were, you know, lucky enough to have the means to be able to board up and leave when something was coming. But, you know, it was the triple whammy of, you know, first Katrina, and then you had Rita, and then you had another active season. It was just like, enough, you know, yeah. and just seeing how things were not recovering at the pace that they wanted to. So they moved back here, and my aunt was excited to see snow and winters again. I think she's finally getting sick of that now, about 11 years later, but.
It's coming. The snow is coming. Although this weekend, I will say, how is there a chance we're going to hit 90?
I think a very good chance.
Really?
You know, my thermodynamic model that I made in college and still use to forecast temperatures gives us a high of 91 on Sunday if it's completely clear. We'll probably have a few high clouds, but, you know, it's going to be very close. I think we will be, you know, yesterday we hit 88 degrees. It was our warmest day in 3.5 weeks. You have to go back to August before Labor Day was the last time we saw that. And yeah, we're going to be very close to that Sunday and Monday. Sunday probably our best chance because we do have a front coming through Monday that is going to touch off potentially some more severe weather. We're going to have to keep our eye on it because what's unusual, we're heading into the time of year that usually when it gets hot, 80s plus, it's usually a dry heat, but it's going to get humid. I mean, Sunday and Monday, it's going to feel like July or early August again. We're talking mid to upper 80s, dew points in the 60s. So there's going to be all the ingredients for potentially severe storms again Monday. This time, hopefully, it looks like more of a, you know, typical late afternoon, evening scenario. And then we're talking about really our first blast of cool fall weather. You know, we've had a random day here or there that's been kind of cool. You know, like today felt cool, but it was actually normal. The normal high now is 72, which is what we hit. But we're talking about a string of 60s potentially next week. And another thing we're looking for that we haven't done yet, which is insane, we have not dropped below 50 yet, officially in the Twin Cities at the airport. That normally should happen sometime at the end of August if we look at the historical average. So this will be a few weeks later than normal. I think we're going to get very close tonight. It is going to be a chilly night tonight with this somewhat cooler air behind last night's storms, clear skies tonight. Most of us in the 40s, but it looks like we'll probably have a couple of those chilly nights next week. And that is what's finally, I think, going to shake some of our trees here in the southern part of the state to really turn color, because those cold nights is what really accelerates things.
I saw that a little bit. And by the way, and we should mention, if you, I will post your latest weather forecast on the social media a little bit later on. Is the fact that we are in September, and when we get cold fronts, I'm going to guess these cold fronts now have a lot more bite to them. Is that when if we get, I mean, I saw your models that said humidity is going to build up, heat's going to build up. Is that, I mean, how dangerous is that? Because, I mean, if you get a real cold front that comes out of Canada, that's, you know, a kind of a normal cold front, that's a pretty substantial drop in temperature. I'm presuming that that's where the problem comes in.
Yeah, we get, you know, and that's the reason why the early part of the summer season is usually the most severe for us when we're not in a drought. You know, May, June is usually the peak of our severe weather season. And further south, you know, it's earlier in the spring. It's because you're starting to heat things up. You know, in the spring, things are heating up rapidly because you have strong sun, but you still definitely have some cold left. It's a little less of a severe scenario this time of year because the cold is developing. So no matter what comes through September, October, it's not going to be as cold as what you'd have in the spring. But we do have some, as we're seeing Sunday, some lingering heat that combined with, yeah, there's a bigger temperature difference than our fronts that come through and say, July and August. So, you know, remember the Arctic finally has darkness now. It just started a couple weeks ago. So cool air is rapidly developing, but there's just so much heat in the Northern Hemisphere this year that it will probably take some time to really cool things off. That's why we're seeing a delay in everything. You know, this cool snap coming next week is really nothing. We're talking about 5 to 7 degrees below normal only.
And so we're looking at cool tonight, warm over the weekend, but
beautiful tomorrow afternoon. Yeah, okay. 75, close to 90, though Sunday it's going to be windy, hot, humid. Sunday warm and humid with those storms in the afternoon. And then, yeah, we will probably stay in the 60s for highs Tuesday, Wednesday with some overnight lows in the 40s. And I also want to remind people that the autumnal equinox, that comes on Wednesday.
Okay.
And we are only 4.5 weeks away from the date last year where we had that blizzard. October 20th. So
delightful.
Keep that in mind.
Thank you for that.
Hopefully we don't have a repeat of that.
One last.
It was a cool September last year, though.
Oh, so. It was. One last plug for you here. I believe this is up on your Premier Living site. You did a breakdown on the drought and drought conditions. Some numbers there, correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yep. And I have to update that every week on Thursdays. We get the new drought monitor information. And I added to it this week a timeline of the historical record for Minnesota back to 1895. Okay. And you can see our wet years and dry years. It's a cool timeline. And I added some dates of interest, like the 1988 drought, the fact that we almost forgot that 2 years ago, 2019 was our wettest year ever. But then also some of things like the 1918 Moose Lake fire, and the Baudette fire of 1910. Those were years of some extreme drought. And, you know, of course, the Dust Bowl years, you can really see the extreme precipitation pattern of our state here over the last 126 years.
I'll make sure I'll link in the latest weather forecast. I'll link in Premier Living. Of course, follow Sven over on YouTube as well as also on Twitter. Sven Zungard, great to talk with you, my friend. Have a great weekend. We'll talk to you next week,
you
okay?
You too.
All right. We'll come back. I got to dance. It's the weekend. We'll come on back to that. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Great to talk to Sven. I was out at I was out roaming a park again today, Kinzel Park, which, by the way, I wanted to quickly mention. You know, when I started doing this park stuff back when the pandemic started, and one of the things that always blew my mind was how many parks I was going to that were within 2 miles of my house, 3 miles of my house, and I had no idea they were there. And I've gotten out, and I highly encourage you that the whole point of us doing that was to get people to go on out and enjoy the parks and go out there and enjoy the setup that's out there. And I hope you do. I hope you do. I was out at Kinzel Park, which is out in Minnetonka. It's right down by the – I've never been there. Now, it's a tiny little thing, but when we're talking to Sven and he's talking about the leaves might start changing, starting to see that a little bit. I think I'm comfortable in saying that even if it doesn't hit 90, I think this might be our last weekend hitting 80s. Not saying it's going to be for sure, but I would say there's a decent chance we're not going to get too much warmer than this back as we get into October and stuff. Occasionally get like a 70-degree day or something like that, but I don't think it's going to get too much. Remind us of that blizzard that came through on the 20th of October last year. And remember, at that point, we were like, oh, it's going to be a normal year. It never was really as bad as that first storm. That first storm was kind of the worst one we had last year. So I hope you get out and enjoy it. I hope you have a wonderful weekend. One of the things that we do here is we dance a little bit. The Linda Lindas. They're harnessing the go-go's for sure. Here's, oh, have a good weekend. We are back on a Monday. Till then, see ya.